Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
There was music in my family home at Christmas. Mario Lanza's Christmas album was played over and over. And after Christmas, my mum and dad entertained all my aunts and uncles who lived in Dublin. And the food for this festive occasion was plentiful. Plates of neatly quartered sandwiches and my mother's cake, apple tart and Christmas pudding. There was talk and storytelling and singing. Lots of singing. Maybe it's for this reason that James Joyce's The Dead is my favourite Christmas story. It recounts a convivial Christmas party hosted by the Morcan sisters and their niece on the Feast of the Epiphany. And Gabriel Conroy, the nephew of the Miss Morcans, is the honoured guest. Joyce wrote The Dead between 1906 and 07 when he was in his mid-20s. He and Nora spent 9 months in Rome, where Joyce worked as a clerk in a bank, before returning to Trieste, where the couple had been living on and off for 3 years. In a letter to his brother Stanislaus, Joyce, writing from Rome, said he wanted to capture something of the hospitality of Dublin in the story, a kind of hospitality he had encountered nowhere else in his travels. The hospitality he had in mind was probably exemplified by the regular gatherings in the Sheehy home in Belvedere Place on the evening of the second Sunday of each month, where young people were invited to visit the family, and the teenage Joyce developed a crush on Mary Sheehy, who later married Tom Kettle. The Sheehys loved music, and their guests were encouraged to sing and perform. Joyce had a sweet voice and liked to sing and play the guitar. Kathleen, one of the Sheehy sisters, and later the mother of Conor Cruise O'Brien, is said to have inspired the character of Molly Ivers in the story. As ever with Joyce, he drew from his own life and family in creating his fiction. Gabriel and his wife Greta are versions of himself and Nora. There was music on both sides of Joyce's family. His father, John Joyce, had a fine tenor voice, and his mother, Mary Jane Murray, studied music and dancing from an early age. Her aunts ran a musical academy at 15 Usher's Island in the 1890s, the house that features in the story. In The Dead, Joyce's grandaunts become the Miss Morcans. The Dead is steeped in music. The title is inspired by one of Moore's melodies, O Ye Dead. In Moore's poem, ghosts converse with the living. Two other songs are central to the story. The first is Arrayed for the Bridal, an adaptation of an aria from Bellini's opera I Puritani, sung by Gabriel's Aunt Julia. As she sings, Gabriel sees the haggard look on her face and understands that his aunt is near to death. The second is a fragment of The Lass of Ockram, which sweeps Greta, Gabriel's wife, away in a flood of remembrance. The song was sung by a young man, Michael Fury, who may have died for love of her. Thereafter, the story is haunted by the shade of Michael Fury. In the celebrated finale of the story, we are told that Gabriel's soul had approached that region where dwell the vast hosts of the dead, and it is music that has conveyed him there. I think Joyce understood the relationship between music and memory better than any other writer I have read. And he understood, too, the interrelationship between the dead and the living. And for me, that interrelationship is felt most acutely at Christmas, that celebration of a birth. We didn't have Bellini at our Christmas parties. The music swung between John McCormack and Vera Lynn, Percy French and the English Music Hall. We met the pretty Kathleen in the garden where the Praties grow. We sat on Mother Kelly's doorstep. We stopped the traffic with a wave of her hand and we marched along with Slattery's mounted foot. Everyone sang, and everyone knew the words of all the songs. And then there were the soloists. My Aunt Kathleen's singing of Danny Boy was exquisite and moved the adults to tears. In another life, my mother might well have been a professional singer, and I can still hear her sing Velia from Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow, my father beaming with love as she sang. I remember, I remember. Always at this time of year, I find the time to play some music to evoke the shades of the dead in loving memory. I listen to Mario Lanza's We Three Kings of Orient Are, Joan Sutherland's lovely version of Velia, and Frank Patterson's The Lass of Ockram from John Huston's 1987 film of the dead. And as I listen, I remember the Christmases of my childhood and look forward to those to come. And I give thanks for the loved ones who gather round me at Christmas, all the living and the dead.
In the late 1980s, myself and my family were living in Laos, one of the five poorest countries in the world and ruled by a hardline communist government. Being an isolated country, the international community there was small, comprising 20 or so embassies, a small number of NGOs and the UN. I first met Boris Kalashnikov through his wife Tanya, who was in my class at the Alliance Française. We were at the international swimming pool where expatriates gathered at the weekend. Tanya and Boris had two teenage children, and I introduced them to my wife Roisin and our three children, who were somewhat younger. As the conversation proceeded, each couple became increasingly fascinated by the other. What, they wondered, was a young Irish family doing in Laos? When I explained that we were working with the Catholic Development Agency Trocora, they were puzzled. Equally, we were intrigued by these Russians, who were clearly part of the communist system. Boris headed up the Novosti Press Agency, which disseminated news and views of the Soviet Union in Laos. As families, we got on very well. Occasionally, we would have lunch together at the swimming pool and visit each other's homes for tea. Boris asked me if he could visit Trocora's office to find out more about our development work. We had a long chat and I showed him some of our publications. He was particularly interested in one article and to my surprise he asked me if he could publish it in his monthly magazine. I agreed and he subsequently published a number of other Trocora articles. One evening we were invited to a reception at the American Embassy. There I was approached by the number two official from the embassy, who began our conversation by saying, "I believe you are a friend of Boris Kalashnikov." I was a little taken aback, but said, "Indeed I was." "Are you aware that he is the head of the KGB here in Laos?" he asked. I replied that I wasn't, and asked him how he knew this. He pointed out that they were the only Soviets that attended the International Swimming Club, and this indicated their special status. I smiled and said that we found the Kalashnikovs very affable, and sure, don't even the KGB need friends. The American official was not impressed. "And anyway," I asked, "what has the CIA done for Catholic development agencies here in Laos recently?" "What do you mean?" he replied, puzzled. So I explained that the KGB were now publishing articles on rural development by Trocora in their monthly magazine. He marched off in a huff. I was intrigued but sceptical at the allegation that Boris was a spy. Boris had a most distinctive swimming style, doing a leisurely breaststroke up and down the pool, while wearing his aviator-style sunglasses. He looked for all the world like a spy, albeit from some spoof James Bond movie. I wondered, was this what CIA intelligence gathering had now come to? As the Russian Orthodox Christmas approached, Boris and Tanya invited our family to join them for Christmas dinner. When we arrived, there were presents carefully wrapped for all the family and a beautiful meal prepared. They said they didn't usually celebrate Christmas, but because we were Christians, they wanted to celebrate it with us. We were quite moved. When dinner was over, they invited us to watch a live broadcast on Russian television of the Christmas liturgy from St. Basil's Cathedral in Red Square. When the Patriarch delivered his sermon, Boris translated for us. We were very touched by their warmth and generosity. As the Soviet Union became gripped in political turmoil, Boris was recalled to Moscow. We guessed we would never see them again. However, some years later, I was in Phnom Penh in Cambodia when a friend there told me that Boris and Tanya were living there and they'd asked her if ever I came to visit to be sure to let them know. That evening, we had an emotional reunion in their apartment. Boris was now downgraded to being a technical advisor at the Russian embassy. They were unhappy with developments in Russia and were far from impressed by Gorbachev. But we shared our experiences of raising moody teenagers and all the normal chat of parents the world over, regardless of what political system they live under. Boris drove me back to my hotel, and as we parted, he said, "You believe in God, and I don't. But certainly somebody up there arranged this night." There followed a big Russian bear hug, and he was gone. We lost contact after that. Christmas cards sent to a Moscow address we had were never acknowledged. Boris and Tanya will be well retired by now, living no doubt on their KGB pension, or not, as the case may be.
My mother wasn't the greatest cook. She was a lovely baker when she found time to make soda bread or a fruitcake, but her culinary offerings weren't terribly exciting. Like many Irish families at the time, we didn't eat meat on Fridays, and somehow my parents happened upon an easy, quick recipe for a Friday dinner when they both got home from school. This involved mixing a can of tuna and a can of tomato soup and serving the result on a bed of brown rice. Penance, indeed. My mother had another tuna recipe, trotted out for special occasions, called Tuna Aurora. This involved more canned tuna, pineapple, and spaghetti. I think she'd found it in an Australian cookbook her students gave her as a Christmas present. What my mother really was good at was encouraging her students. She taught for most of her professional life at the same boarding school close to our home in Rathfarnham in Dublin. She was deeply committed to her girls and cared very much about their development. She really believed in them and, if I may borrow a line from Maeve Binchy, all her geese were swans. When a former student was in a play or doing stand-up, we'd go along. If one had a baby, she'd send a note. On the rare occasion that one of her girls died, she was deeply upset. She was invested in them, and so she felt their losses, and particularly their successes. When the school closed, she couldn't face the idea of working anywhere else, and from the leftovers of this teaching life, she built a whole new career of teaching teachers. The student who had the most practical impact on our family life remains totally anonymous to me. Back in 1988, when we were all happily celebrating Dublin's millennium, a milling company ran a national competition encouraging people to invent recipes that could have been made by Dubliners 1,000 years ago. The vast majority, and the eventual winner, all made cakes. But one of Mammy's students entered with a savoury dish called chicken natural, or naturelle to be fancy. And she came second. The dish combined chicken with yogurt and soup and had a topping made from breadcrumbs, oatmeal and, of course, a bit of butter. This recipe is delicious and fairly easy to make. It had the perfect amount of history and personal connection to get a conversation going at a dinner party. In our house, it changed everything. I'd say nearly every dinner guest that came to our home for the next 2 decades got a taste of it, served proudly from the big handmade terracotta baking dish by the light of our pink lamp on the piano in the dining room. It's over a decade since my mother died, but I still make chicken naturelle once a year or so, and I cook it not with chicken, but with extra turkey and ham from the Christmas dinner. Technically, there were no turkeys in ancient Difflin, but that's all right. It's the perfect meal for these bleary, soft days between Christmas and the cold day in early January when the fairy lights are switched off. In these days, the leftovers of 1 year, the new one just beginning, our memories seem to glow a little brighter and the past smells a little closer. I love that I have this useful, easy and delicious recipe, all the more nostalgic since it encapsulates the spirit of my mother, encouraging her students, sharing their successes. I wish I knew the name of the girl who invented this recipe back in the late 1980s. I wish I knew how proud my mother was of her work, even if she didn't eventually win. I wish I knew how many guests she helped us feed. And I wish she knew how her little recipe, perhaps forgotten everywhere else, is still in my mammy's baking folder, and it brings her just a little back to me every year.
Now it is Chanukah, and I lit a candle to memory. The soft flicker of a single flame, the first of 8 candles, to be lit throughout the days of this holiday, lights up a faint nostalgia in me for the old copper menorah in my childhood home, the traditional candelabra standing guard in the darkened window. It had been smuggled from hiding place to hiding place during World War II, getting battered and dented along the way. But there it was, years later, ready to shine on our childish faces. I linger in that nostalgia for the duration of the burning of this one candle. The next 2 candles could hold a promise of presents for all, of songs to be sung, and that the flaming light might last. According to the story, the lights kept burning for 8 days, even though there was only enough oil for 1. 8 candles are lit in total to celebrate a miracle and in memory of people being liberated from an oppressor to live in freedom. The winter cold encloses our days in Dublin, where we stay inside and read off screens or pages to learn, or even wish sometimes we could unlearn what others tell us about the world. We watch small miracles unfold around us. They light up briefly, like Chanukah candles. Over the course of the last year, I have sat for long hours among sick human beings, some of whom share the same ailment I suffer from, who keep their heads bent as if their newly acquired baldness is too heavy a weight for them to be able to sit up straight and look up, maybe to a future. For me, a future would mean more understanding and the ability to strike a match and cast a miraculously lasting light on the events in our lives, to line up facts into minute details, including the insufferable misunderstandings of war, racial injustice, poverty, hunger, and incurable illnesses. I'm not a religious person, and what I have learned from reading various writings from different faiths has always only been of cultural interest to me. However, when performing Bach's compositions, I hope I adhered to his Christian faith, whereas improvising music with my Iranian or Indian musician friends led me into Muslim or Buddhist worlds, reaching for a different tonal horizon. I have stood and admired many paintings by the great Italian and Flemish masters that represented their profound belief in religious myth and stories. Amongst them is an etching by Rembrandt called The Star of the Kings, which refers to the biblical story of the three kings and Twelfth Night, when three kings bearing gifts followed a star which led them to the infant Jesus in Bethlehem. These days, I can often get quite tired, and sometimes, when out for a walk, I need to sit down for a bit to rest. A week or so ago, I couldn't walk any further and had to sit down on a bench in a pedestrian street in Dublin city centre. It was cold, and I noticed that the man sitting beside me was wearing lots of layers over his hoodie. He was smoking a rolled cigarette when he turned to me. His eyes were dark, nearly black. His bearded face looked like a figure from a Caravaggio or a Rembrandt painting. I greeted him with a slightly exhausted "Hi," and he told me he was Ibrahim from Egypt. He worked as a chef in a nearby pizzeria. He was from Alexandria originally, and we quickly sailed over to Egypt in our chat about the magical library there. We even ended up singing a bit of music by the legendary Egyptian singer Umm Kulthum, who had been one of the first to take me to a different universe outside the European repertoire. Meanwhile, Ibrahim was very kind to me, as concerned about my well-being as if I were his closest friend. He could not return to Egypt at the moment, he said. He had to stay in Dublin, where he was hoping for a miracle to happen. I nodded. That made two of us. I kept looking at his biblical appearance, trying to place him into a painting, a time frame, and then I remembered Rembrandt's The Star of the Kings. It was clear to me then that I had met one of them, Ibrahim, the pizza chef, who was smoking away while gifting me with kindness. Now it is Hanukkah, the Jewish holiday of long-lasting light, of gifts, of songs that can be sung in any language or tonality as far as I am concerned, of an everlasting fight against the oppressors of miracles. I had met a king who gave me the gift of kindness. As for a miracle, well, I will hold on to my battered, smuggled menorah.
يا حبيبي يا حبيبي اللي نو السماء ونجومه
It was close to midnight on a late summer evening. In the warm, still air, the candles in my garden didn't even flicker. Unlike the conversation, animated, exuberant, and above all happy. Just three of us remained from the group of eight, silently unwilling to let the evening die. And with good reason. "Isn't she wonderful?" he asked me sotto voce, looking across the table at his wife. She was, always had been, and on this evening was doubly so, and doubly beloved to him. Gerald Orr was speaking of his wife Dorothea, her elbows on the table, her eyes glowing in the candlelight, wine glass within reach, and laughter never far from the surface. Dorothea and her poet and academic husband had good reason to be happy that evening some 15 years ago. She had been given the all clear after major cancer surgery, which she had successfully battled with the grim determination and unmitigated courage so bewildering to those of us lucky enough to be untouched by that horrible and cruel disease. So it had been a joyous evening, with both of them in gleeful form. In the company of Jerry and Dorothea, that was usually mischievous, frequently irreverent, and always razor sharp. Over the years of our friendship, I don't recall any other mood prevailing, although for Jerry, a late hour could be accompanied by the hint of a scowl if things got heated. "If everyone doesn't stop talking rubbish, I'm going to bed," I remember him announcing from the head of his own hospitable dinner table on one occasion. Everyone laughed, but he meant it. The talk was political, and the horror of the Troubles was a personal passion for Jerry, as his massive output of poetry and prose bore witness to over the years from his earliest writings in his native Belfast. As a writer and thinker, Gerald Orr had the magical gift of immersing himself in the now while allowing past wisdom, his own and that of others, to allow the now to become both wider and more compassionate. He could be angry, but never ungenerous. His writing always managed to grasp an atmosphere, sketch a place, and draw in the reader to the heart of how he saw his surroundings. It was what made his company glitter, embedding us in the amber of his world. When he arrived in Galway to teach at the then UCG, he became a Galway man, but a Galway man with the extra dimension of his Belfast childhood amongst women. He had grown up in a household of women, an only male child and, one suspects, an adored one, but yet never seeming to feel a sense of privileged entitlement. And the baggage of double wisdom accompanied him and Dorothea to Dublin when he came to Trinity to co-set up the Oscar Wilde School, settling in what became his beloved Dunleary, where they spent the last 30 years of his life, and always referred to by them both as the Borough. A native of it myself, their sense of place always shamed me by its depth and commitment and ever-present awareness of its high Victorian past. That night, when we celebrated Dorothea's emergence from the shadow of illness and pain, they'd arrived, as usual, dripping packages. Not for Jerry and Dorothea the polite bottle of wine, but an exuberant bouquet and at least two books, always insightfully dedicated and signed, always another writer's work, and usually Jerry's latest, now doubly precious. There was always a latest. Gerald Orr was prolific. And yes, a bottle of wine, and probably some lethal chocolates and an exotically scented candle. None of us knew, how could we? That particular evening was only the beginning of a shadowland. Because Dorothea would have 10 years' respite until the night she whispered to me, "My thing is back, don't talk about it in front of him." And together they fought her thing once again. Once again, and once again it was victory, albeit a slightly shaky one. And in the midst, the terrible, ironic in the circumstances, cancer diagnosis for Jerry. Right through COVID and its devastation, they refused to give up. Every new intervention was seen, at least outwardly, as a silver bullet. There was cheeky preening at the retention, despite intensive chemotherapy, of what Jerry said his oncologist described as his fine head of hair. And still, the poet wrote, the social historian continued to catalogue his surroundings with a radio documentary on his adopted seaside home. The rock and roll kid of 1970s Belfast never disappeared. Van Morrison was still king, his music still an inspiration. In knowing, we loved him, said Reverend Miazan Ian Kilroy at the memorial service for Jerry earlier this year, in the beautiful surroundings of the Maritime Museum in Dunleary, where friends and colleagues read some of his poetry, and the music included, yes, retrospectively defiant, Van the Man's Into the Mystic.
Born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonny boat was one as we sailed.
Many years ago, as a young reporter in Dublin working in the Sunday Tribune, I was sent along to the Shelburne Hotel to interview the writer Edna O'Brien. She was inspirational, and I've never forgotten her grace and gentleness. This poem is in tribute to her. I'll read it in Irish first, then in English. Rún an scríonóra, I gcuine Edna O'Brien. Hig si an dolag mar ala, a kraken co bán le plúr, a súla co glas le hishka, a quim co cael le bjur an glana. Dairiga gruig in a cornini fiona, darag mar iachtar na spéra agus an gríana dol fé. Agus adas a vísi a kaint, vóg a géag a tani fuin a skirt a siadúl, mar sharach ag buin tríal as a chosa. Hit a goch mar chloc o hiachtar an tobar nur a laursi os ísil. Vi a focal miata, co sisarnach le tach na styrma. Tiamán raig in a mós de sprid na vochel, a volsi. Aulis gwyl tu go homlan cailte shana chiar, gan sailse, vohrin uignach, i roch na hiha, a mwifuin dua, i dir i vad i gain. The Writer's Secret, in memory of Edna O'Brien. She sat on the couch like a swan, her skin as white as flower, her eyes as green as glass, her waist as narrow as the V in the glen. Her hair was a mass of curls, red like the horizon at sunset. And all the time she was talking, her legs shifted thin under her silk skirt, like a foal trying out its limbs. When she spoke quietly, her voice fell like a stone to the bottom of the well. Her words were measured, rustling like the coming of a storm. Keep driving on with due regard for the spirit of the words, she advised, as if you were completely lost in an old car with no lights on a lonely boreen in the middle of the night, somewhere out in the country, in a land far away.
Happenstance. And then there is the man alone on his balcony, taking the last smoke of the day, looking here and there. Whatever might be on his mind floats in the breeze, away from the derelict yard, the darkening lane, and the still and silent sky. He in his spot, I in mine, unknown to each other, for only the second we share.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Dead at Christmas by Kevin McDermott. My Friend the Spy by the late Justin Kilcullen, first broadcast in 2018. Leftovers was by Conor Hannity. Hanukkah by the late Judith Mock, first broadcast last year. Human Wishes in Memoriam Gerald Daw was by Emer O'Kelly. Runan Scríonóra, The Writer's Secret in Memory of Edna O'Brien, a poem by Catherine Foley. And Happenstance, a poem by Gerald Daw. The music was The Lass of Ockram, sung by Frank Patterson. The theme from The Spy Who Came In from the Cold by Roland Shaw and his orchestra. Auld Lang Syne by Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians. Alf Lilia Liwa Lilia by the Egyptian singer Kelfoum. Into the Mystic by Van Morrison. And Dulcis Ime from Carl Orff's Carmina Burana, sung by Lucia Popp. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And a selection of the late Gerald Daw's essays and music goes out at 6 p.m. on New Year's Eve in a programme called The First Time I Heard, here on RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.